sneaker culture literature is no different than New England Romanticism, is no different than postmodern Southern Lit, because these individuals have lives and stories and issues the same way that in Faulkner, everyone has a life and they have issues, right? But the point is this, a good number of students I've taught in the Souls of Black Folk or in the class Soul Food Digestible Sneaker Culture, many of them are not subscribers to sneaker culture. But what they do recognize is like, wait a minute, this is an opportunity to take something other than Dickinson, other than Faulkner, other than Melville, other than Alice Walker. So this represents, this is still lit, but yeah, just talking about different things. And the rules of literature apply. Nothing changes. The same way right. We want to talk about symbols in literature.
Before we get started, please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others. Now, let's get to it. Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community. Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I am a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you're here. Today's conversation is with Dr. Jemaine LeVar King. Jemaine is creative, insightful, and very intentional. He is the founder of Soul Food Brand LLC. Soul is spelled S-O-L-E, which you will come to appreciate. And among many other things, his company celebrates HBCUs, or historically Black colleges and universities. He holds a Bachelor of Arts in English News Media from Elizabeth City State University, a Master of Arts in English Literature from Virginia State University, and a PhD in English Literary Criticism from Indiana State University of Pennsylvania. He is currently an Associate Professor of English at Virginia State University. Remember how I said creative and intentional? Jemaine is also the creator and founding director of the Virginia State University Institute of Hip Hop and Cultural Studies, which includes a Hip Hop Studies English minor and the world's first collegiate English course dedicated to sneaker culture, literature, and identification within sneaker culture. Yeah, I know, right? He is the author of Soul Food, Digestible Sneaker Culture, and a forthcoming book titled The Big House on Flavian. It's a bold and poetic exploration of memory, masculinity, and the mythology of America viewed through the immersive lens of the video game Red Dead Redemption 2. Jemaine, welcome to Curated Questions.
Ken, I am honored and I am thankful and humbled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Just by that introduction, as we were talking about it before we got started, the collection of words that I have in this introduction, I know that this is just going to be an amazing conversation. So this is fantastic. I like to start always with the same question, and that is, when did you first understand the power of questions?
I understood first the power of questions when I realized that some of the passions that I had or have, by some, were not considered to be academic. So the question is, why isn't that considered academic when it's already been valued for its commercialization, some of the interests, or for just revenue purposes? So again, that was instrumental in a lot of the things that we'll talk about today.
Was there a particular trigger point that you connected to say, wait a second, this stuff is making serious money out there? But what was an example of that moment where you noticed that connection was not being made?
Twofold. When I began my PhD journey at IUP, we were requested to meet with the chair of the program. My meeting was scheduled right after one of my classes, and he had a couple questions. The first question was, my employer at that time was Johnson C. Smith University. And he was like, tell me about JCSU, because he knew it was HBCU, but he didn't know anything else about it. And I thought for a second, I'm like, okay, how do I explain Smith to someone who does not know about Smith? So I had a thought, like a detailed of what I was going to say. And he cut me off and he said, how is it like Howard? And I thought, I'm like, well, they're both established the same year and they're both private. That's how it's like, you know, they were both established the same year. They're both private institutions. And they, from that conversation, he had mentioned Soul Food, which was out a couple of years before that. And he used the term, of course, capital L literature. And we all know what capital L literature is. Some of my favorite, and maybe even some of your favorite pieces of literature will qualify as that. But that question, he mentioned that, for example, Moby Dick, which absolutely is capital L literature, and what it did for the whaling industry for Melville, that one of the greatest things ever written, okay? And I'm like, okay, but if he clearly sees, and so do I, if he sees Moby Dick as capital L, and he's kind of sunning Soul Food, and I'm not saying he shouldn't have, but I thought like, wow, in my universe, Bobbito Garcia's Where'd You Get Those? That is the Moby Dick of sneaker culture literature. That literally, that is it. That book is Moby Dick, okay? So from there, that coupled with I sat in a meeting. And, you know, some meetings are great, most aren't. This particular meeting was significant for that school, for me, and for things that just came after it. The question was asked by the department chair at the time, does anyone have any ideas for any new courses? Why did he ask that? This is why he asked. The English major at that time was under attack. And I talk about this all the time. For some students who were matriculating to that institution and other institutions saw the English major as being archaic. So essentially he was asking, how do we not be archaic? I had no intention of answering that. Even though I had answers, I had no intention of answering that question. I was just sitting there like that old, Marshawn Lynch, I'm just here so I won't get fined. Like when he was at the press conference, I'm like, I'm here because it's in my contract. So I sat there quiet and then it was like, Jermaine, what? And it ended up coming, Soul Food, the class Soul Food came from that particular meeting. I realized to answer your question, when I sat with the chair of my PhD program and he was asking about, you know, tell me about your workplace. And as we're talking about literature, and he mentioned like, okay, this is capital L. It's almost like, I don't know what this is, right? But this is academic. The same way a meal may be a delicacy in someone's home and it may be a snack in someone else's or something they would eat because they have nothing else to eat. It's all about perspective. But the thing is, there are students who are matriculating to college and the careers they're about to go into in 4 years or 5 years or 6 years or seven, the careers they're going into don't exist currently. Some of those careers are not made yet.
Yeah.
Thus, a curriculum, this offense that we've been running, right? The same offense that Red Grange was running may not be as conducive for success for 5, 6, 7 years down the line. And when we think of how technology is influencing commerce and how it's just influencing life and careers, there are individuals who may not see the value in a liberal arts education. They may be bettered by one, but again, how do you show that a liberal arts education can get you from this point to where you want to be? And sometimes, as I've already mentioned, where you want to be, you may not know because it may not exist yet. So those two exchanges and those two questions brought us here.
Other than the fact that they were willing to branch out or expand, do you think that was the right question to be asking? And if it wasn't, would there have been a better question to be asking?
No, the question they asked of me?
Yeah, in that meeting, or the combination of the two meetings.
Yes, I do believe, especially the question from the department chair about saying, how do we create new classes? Because the first step of recognizing that there's a storm coming is to open the door and take a look outside, right? Or, you know, maybe test the air or just look at it, how the winds are blowing. And that meeting was a forecast. Like, that was a microcosm of just college, period, right? Of liberal arts education institutions. We need to reimagine this major. We need to reimagine pedagogy. We need to reach students where they are, no matter where they are. And that sounds a little loaded. Where they are doesn't mean that they're below or above the standard. It just means they may not see the value of Hemingway. They may not see the value of Faulkner. And these are two names where my eyes light up whenever someone mentions them. They may not see the value, and they may not see the connection of how that can get them to a career that they would like to have, whether it exists or not. Both questions that were asked were appropriate, because to achieve change, you have to change something. In the formula, in the routine, in the curriculum, in the thinking, in the bias. So I don't have a problem with either of those questions. I don't rate one more important than the other, because when it comes to literature, it seems a lot of literature is ridiculous until it makes money or until it builds a community. Zora Neale Hurston, unfortunately, did not live to see the success of her writings. Yeah. And man, whenever I hear someone praise her, it feels good, because again, we talk about Southern literature, or even postmodern Southern literature, her works are right there, right? They're right there with the greats, because she is of the great. But unfortunately, she didn't get a chance to live to see that type of success. At some point, someone realized, like, hey, we got something here. There's a voice of individuals who have not been addressed, and we can make money off this. So you can always make someone see the monetary value. All of a sudden, it becomes legitimized. I want to say this, too, even if you haven't asked me this. Southern hip hop and Southern literature are one and the same, because at one point, people didn't see value in either. With Southern literature, the people from the South are stupid, so the stuff that they write is going to be stupid. And within hip hop culture, same thing. Those people down South aren't that creative. They don't have anything to talk about except for sowing fields and doing domestic chores. What are they rapping about? So there's a tie-in there. And those questions that were asked mirror what happened with Southern literature and mirror what happened in hip hop with Southern hip hop.
So full disclosure here, I am clueless really about the hip hop world. A kid of the 80s, but I grew up in Central Arizona. So there wasn't a lot of influence from outside of middle Arizona. And so I missed out on the beauty of hip hop growing in the 80s as it exploded and went certainly national and worldwide. As I get a chance to have conversations with folks who do have this rich history and all these memories built with the music, I can appreciate, I just don't share those. And there's a little bit of missing out because hip hop has become what it has been, just reference wise. So I don't know the difference between Southern, then more, I guess, probably more bigger classification would just be East Coast being New York-ish and then West Coast. I just don't have the background to know the difference between those. And so the folks that have come out of the South in the world of hip hop, what do you think it took for the rest of the hip hop community to really see that there was something of value? Was there a particular artist or a particular song?
So if we're making a comparison of Southern hip hop to Southern literature, and then that awakening or that moment where you're like, oh man.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah.
Like, this is of high quality. A lot of purists and a lot of fans will point to the group Outkast as the artist who literally changed that. And there are other artists who came before them who you could credit. But for the mainstream, more than likely Outkast, right? If you're if you were to talk to someone from Houston, Texas, or from the state of Texas, they would mention a group like UGK, right? Because UGK was established before Outkast. And there are other groups. People from Florida may mention Two Live Crew, who were national in the mid and late 80s, right? Or they were international, to be quite honest. So it just depends on how big and what particular time. But what opened the eyes, a group like Outkast, what, or maybe even the Ghetto Boys, right, in Houston as well. So Texas has a lot to say about this. And they were in the late 80s and early 90s as well. But the lyrics and the subject matter was relatable because they were talking about things that people experienced from the South and not Queens, not even Massachusetts, like not just the East Coast. And the production quality was high. And the actual rhyming itself was high. So when you put all those things together, it's like, wait a minute. I had no idea, not me, but one, maybe a cynic. Maybe I had no idea that individuals from the South were able to produce this level of art. And again, when I say it's the same as Southern, it is the same thing. People thought people from the South were dumb and that they had nothing to write about. And if they did, who wants to read that? But a lot of individuals will point to perhaps the Ghetto Boys, maybe UGK. And a lot of people would point to the group Outkast because, again, whether it be Big Boy or Andre 3000, they have the skill set of any lyrical artist that you can point to. It just so happens to be that they're from Atlanta.
This is just fun being in the deep end of the pool, splashing around. So let's talk about the lyrical piece of it, especially with your English background or the literature background. How is it different between the major regions? Is it specifically just the individual themselves, you know, Outkast or these individuals that come up? Is it their particular talent? They just happen to be the one that can bring the rhymes? Or is there an element of culture and region that plays more of a role than just 10%, make up a small percentage or something like that? Is that how it works, or is there more of a higher percentage of cultural influence than the 10% that I'm throwing out?
So as far as percentages, I don't know what percentage I'd put on it, but I will say this. What got Southern rap over, how it appealed to the masses, were that the stories were authentic. It would be the same, I guess, the same way of watching a show. Like, for example, Magnum P.I. When I was a child, watched a lot of Magnum P.I., especially during the summer because it was summertime. Okay, I had no idea that he was from where I was from. Like, he was from the 757, right? But watching that show, I felt like I knew what Hawaii felt and smelt like just because of how it's portrayed on the show. Had I been to Hawaii at that point? Absolutely not. I was a child, and my parents were taking me there. But watching that show, even though you got to see elements of a whole lot of the surroundings or the way of life there, the way that the show was wrapped in that, I had an idea in my mind of, okay, it's like this there. And as I grew up, I would always pay attention when people would talk about being in that state of like how things were important. So how much things cost, right? Like bread was, when I was a kid, bread was $50. I'm like, what? Like, oh my gosh, right? That was a popular thing in the 80s. And then people would say that bread was so expensive there. And that the McDonald's had Spam. Like, you could buy Spam in the McDonald's.
Yeah.
So if I would make that comparison, when one would listen to, like, a Southern artist, like Outkast or UGK or even, goodness, so many of them, The Brat, The Real Mr. Biggs, right? But they would talk about their experiences so detailed that you felt like you were there. You could relate to it. And there's elements of just them talking about. So hip hop for many is the psalm or the proletariat. Okay. It literally is the psalm of the proletariat or the song of the proletariat. And because you talk about music of individuals who don't have a voice, the voiceless, usually the foundation of society. You know, it doesn't matter if you're from Queens or if you're from Decatur, that story is the same. The package is different.
Yeah.
So the fact that the message was pretty much the same as how it related to a lot of individuals and the packaging, there are individuals who buy products because of the marketing, because of the package. knowing that that didn't sound exactly like that, but I could hear the similarities, or, you know, I'm going to hear something different. So all that had a lot to say about how Southern hip hop found its place. And then at one point, Southern hip hop became the dominant version of hip hop. And for many, still is. So I don't know about percentages, but the way that it was presented, the message was the same, but the seasoning was different.
Yeah.
And that helped. Okay. That helped a lot of people realize, like, hey, this is valid. And these individuals have a voice. And heck, I may not live there, but this LL Cool J talked about that too. Or KRS-One talked about that too. Like, Goody Mob is another popular group that one may liken to, not necessarily in the sonic boom of the sound, but one may liken the Goody Mob to Public Enemy. They're talking about the same social issues, just from different parts of the United States. So that went over well with a lot of individuals.
It sounds like it really is the storytelling component of it that resonates with what is that thread of human experience, and being able to make that clear and make that evident. That's what's going to be able to take it outside of the region.
Yes. The art of storytelling and the actual message. And the message was the same, but the art of storytelling and also production cues that went along with that, and rhyme styles and dialect. It's almost like if we were making a gumbo and I'm like, Ken, bring this, and I want to bring that, and have someone bring this, and it all mixes together and ends up being not only edible, but delicious. So
on the topic of hip hop, specifically music, then what can we learn about questions from hip hop?
Okay. We can learn, if we were to ask the question, how does hip hop set a precedent for the rest of society? If we were to ask that question, the answers would take us here. So 25 years ago, okay, 25, 30 years ago, almost as far back as you want to go, okay? Within hip hop music and culture, there was an obsession with homosexuality, or what is masculinity. When I say obsession, meaning like there was a column in a hip hop publication monthly that tongue in cheek, perhaps, attempt to identify, let's find the gay rapper. That was a column, I believe it, from my memory, I believe that was XXL. That's off the top of the dome. I hope I haven't got my publications mixed up. But there was a column trying to identify, is this the gay? Is this the gay rapper? Based off of this interaction, based off of this lyric, based off where they were, that type of thing. Today, if we're asked a question, I would argue that society is mirroring hip hop. What do I mean? This is what I mean. Today in 2025, hip hop, believe it or not, is a safe space for individuals to be who they are, because somewhere there's somebody who's listening for someone who represents them. Now, you know, 20 years ago, a hyper-masculine artist would not want to appear on a project with someone from the LGBTQIA+. And today, people aren't batting an eye, and that's beautiful. So the question, how does hip hop, I won't use the term mirror because society is mirroring hip hop, but how does hip hop set a precedent or opens avenues for society? You know, there are individuals from all walks of life, from all creeds and colors, who are practitioners of the art. Many are celebrated, some not as much as others. But hip hop has become a safe space, and 25, 30 years ago, it was not safe at all. So with that, it is good to see that society is in some ways mirroring where hip hop is going. Well, think about this. Consumerism, since hip hop began, attempted to use hip hop for a company's purpose. I don't know if you remember those post commercials, like the post cereal for, was it Fruity Pebbles and Cocoa Pebbles?
Okay.
Okay. If we were to sit and just pull up 80s commercials, I would argue if we just pulled up, let's say 40 commercials, 40 commercials from the 80s, no less than 25% of them are incorporating hip hop in the market. And now it depends on what the product is, of course, but hip hop was so popular, was such a thing that some people thought it was a fad, but it was such a thing that companies were like, hey, let's have Fred and Barney rapping about Fruity Pebbles. Let's have, you know, a Nintendo rap. Like, The Legend of Zelda is really rad. Those creatures from Ganon are really bad, right? I remember that from childhood, okay?
Right, right.
Yeah. So I remember writing in my dissertation that it was the top music genre, and it still is. One of my reviewers had a problem with that, even though it was factual at the time. And it, again, and it still is. I mean, it has replaced rock as a top genre. And that's not a knock to rock, because I love rock like I love hip hop. But the facts are the facts. So with all this change, because hip hop has definitely changed how people market, whether it be to African Americans, whether it be to the working class, whether it's to the bourgeoisie, that change also comes with acceptance. Because if you're going to let that in, you got to let a few other things in too, and that is gorgeous.
For the LGBTQIA plus community, the acceptance within hip hop, was that driven by acceptance of any particular artist? Or do you think that was driven by friendships, associations with artists, with their friends, and just community, not necessarily a particular artist being a part of that community?
That's a wonderful question. I really believe that it was driven by the definition of what is masculinity, that changing, and also by artists. Here's the thing, and I don't want to compare it to compare this period, even though there's some similarities, and I'm about to do it. I don't want to compare it to civil rights, where think about University of Alabama and their football team. Okay. When other institutions began to admit African-American students, they were also bringing in African-American student athletes. And from my memory, it didn't take Bear Bryant too long to recognize, like, I get down or I lay down. And meaning either I get with the program or we're going to lose. And I don't want to do that. So what happens is, when you have within LGBTQIA plus community, if somebody in hip hop, if you have skills, like you can, if literally, if you can flow, if you literally can, are you that dude or that person or that woman or whatever you identify, if you are that individual, you are here and we are fans of your work. And you got to remember, as I mentioned before, the artists are a microcosm of their audience. So they could be rapping for someone who, like, I can't believe that there's someone who looks like me, who dresses like me, who's from where I'm from, who is doing this for me. So I believe partially due to how we define masculinity, like it or not, it's changing, right? What's the term? A merce, which is what, a man purse?
Yeah.
And again, not here to critique anyone's fashion choices. Well, I guess I would when it comes to sneaker culture, but I'm not going to condemn someone for things. But the whole point is, this is the thing. Yeah. When I was in college, there's no way a guy would walk around campus with anything other. If it was going to be like a bag, it would be something like a book bag, right? A knapsack, right? Not, or maybe even a briefcase, an attaché, a Halliburton, if you will, right? And instances of that, but not with something that resembled what they call a man bag, right? An individual would have questioned your masculinity, and people aren't doing that anymore. And that's good, because again, we should all feel safe, no matter where we are. We should feel safe, not only in proximity, but we should feel safe in expressing who we actually are. And I believe now, it's not 100%, of course. Nothing is absolute, even that statement. But hip hop is a safer place than it was 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago.
That's fantastic that it has been on this leading edge or part of that leading edge to help bring about change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, let's pivot to sneaker culture.
Okay.
Another one of your favorite topics or very close to your heart. How did sneakers capture your heart?
Oh, man, that's a, how did sneakers capture my heart? So there are things before sneaker culture was recognized as a culture. There were individuals like me who would pay attention to things that, you know, some would have deemed not worthy of paying attention to. For example, why does this particular sneaker exist in this colorway for this particular purpose? And why, this is before retro was a thing. And historically, what we know now is retro within sneaker culture, because you want to make a case, well, the Chuck Taylor All-Star has been made from since 19, not that, okay? Retro became a thing about 1999, when it became a real thing. Even though there were sneakers that were retroed, the Adidas Pro Model Superstar, the Air Force One from 1982 on, there were certain shoes that lived on, but most shoes, when the production run ended, that was it. And there were individuals within the culture before it was recognized as a culture, recognized like, hey, I like this. And Garcia actually said this before as well. I like this. If I want to be able to have this shoe, either I don't wear it or I get multiple pairs. And that became a little easier because sneakers are always going, even today, they still go on sale. So recognizing that I paid attention to certain things that most people just like didn't see value in. Like something as simple as, why are you walking on the side? Why are you adamant about not walking in grass? Because I don't want my sneakers to look dirty, right?
Yeah.
And also, you know, being in this subculture, you recognize that that film, there's a film that exists on new sneakers that breaks down. And when that film breaks down, they begin to wear. Like they begin to appear dirty. Like there's almost like a force field of this particular film. And you speed up that process, whether it be with the oxidation by stepping on dirt and grass with the oxygen, or just by walking. And so you want to, the goal was, I want my sneakers to not look like they're busted because I don't know when my next pair is coming. So I need to take care of the pair that I have or the pairs that I have.
I was reading your book, Soul Food. If you could define retro specifically for folks, because there's going to be some folks that, like myself, didn't understand that term. Your book helped with it. So if you can define that, so then as we go forward, then that'll be clear.
Sure. Retro in regard to sneaker culture represents a silhouette that is out of production that has been brought back into production. For example, I'm going to give you an example of a shoe that's not in production. The Team Jordan, the Air Jordan Vindicate. The Vindicate was a signature shoe for Vin Baker, who at that time was a Jordan brand signature athlete. Now, within popular culture or even within sneaker culture, anything that is not a original Air Jordan within the people who wear Air Jordans, they look down on anything else, like the takedown. And the term takedown means a model. Think of a Corolla being cheaper, even though it's still a great Toyota. Think of a Corolla as being a budget Toyota and maybe something like the Crown being a higher quality with more feature sedan. So you have an economy sedan and you have the Crown. So you may have something like a Air Jordan Revolution, which is the original name of the Air Jordan 3. People now call it the Air Jordan 3, even though the original name was the Air Jordan Revolution. They would see that as being canon. These are shoes that Michael wore. This is a popular shoe. Aesthetically, it's beautiful. They would say that. And they may look at a shoe like the Vindicate as being, oh, that's just a Team Jordan. Even though when the Vindicate originally released in 1998-99, that shoe was better looking than the actual Jordan from that year, and it was really popular. So the Vindicate is not in production. If you were to open up YouTube or social media, Instagram, Facebook, and see ads for the Vindicate tomorrow, and if you're a subscriber, authentic or inauthentic, the sneaker culture, oh, snap, they're bringing the Vindicate back. So retro refers to a sneaker silhouette that is out of production, that is going to be brought back into production, maybe with some subtle changes, but it's the same shoe.
Within sneaker culture, because folks are paying attention to those details, all of that would be understood within the community of what version this is, when it came out. And as I was thinking about our conversation, it seems to me that sneaker culture could be kind of a stand-in for virtually any collectible, whether it's baseball cards or, you know, this idea of collecting and appreciating and being in conversation about an object or a collection of things. What do you think is the foundation supporting the desire, the practice of collecting?
When it comes to sneaker culture generally, or even specifically within collecting, it is an extension of the individual. So it's a lifestyle. It's a thought process, a belief. And that builds a community of kindred spirits and appropriating spirits. It's all about expression. So definitely all about expression. And individuals express themselves via their footwear the same way they would express themselves via the things that they read, the things that they watch, the way that they dress, the way that they talk. So it is a form of expression. It is also a community of subscribers. And I mentioned this a moment ago, but you have authentic sneaker culture subscription and you have inauthentic sneaker culture subscription. And I can explain them quickly and easily this way. Authentic sneaker culture subscription has a foundation of knowledge. Okay. Not necessarily about consumerism, even though consumerism exists, commodification, all these things exist within the culture, but authentic subscription is more concerned with knowledge and also expression. But expression is involved in inauthentic and authentic. But let me go deeper. You mentioned you're from Arizona, right? Hmm. I would put money on, and I'm not a gambling man, as they say. I would put money on that if you were home, you could recognize if someone were from your hometown probably pretty quickly. Because there are elements, there's ways that we communicate things verbally and non-verbally. And if they verbally begin to communicate, you're like, oh, wait a minute, you're not from around here, are you, right? That's no different within authentic and inauthentic subscription. For example, if I were to walk into, and I do this to this day, and I used to do this for entertainment on the first day of class years ago. I stopped because of technology, but this is what I would do on the first day of class. It is my belief that on the first day of class, you don't start lecturing. You clearly cover the syllabi and you make sure that, hey, this is the offense that we're running here. This is where you go for this. This is where you go for that. So the first day is informative. And that's going to be quicker than 50 minutes, right? I may go 30 minutes with that. And if I'm really in season mode, it might be 20 minutes. But this is what I used to do. On the first day of class, I would say to the students, well, you know, I've covered the material I wanted to cover today. I'm going to dismiss you by, you know, depending, this is all depending on my success rate. I'm going to dismiss you. I want to attempt to guess where you're from without you telling me anything. And if you want to give me a hint, you can give me a creative hint, but you can tell me like geography, like just to give me a hint if you want to. But I was going down the line like, bam, 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 bam. And the students were like, how does he do this? How was I doing it? I was identifying how they were communicating where they were from by the way they were dressed. A lot of times it was the sneakers. Now sneaker culture is everybody's wearing the same thing because of the internet. But in 2009, 2006, 2012, it wasn't necessarily that way. So I could look at someone and be like, oh, you're from the Bay Area of California, aren't you? What? How'd you know? I'm like, you pretty much told me with those bands that you're wearing, right? Those all white band slides that you're wearing. Yeah, you're definitely from the Bay Area. Or there's this term, Reebok, they refer to them as soldieries, okay? That's the nickname for them, soldieries. This is a shoe primarily worn, we're talking like in states like South Carolina and Louisiana, okay? Parts of Georgia. But because the school was located near South Carolina, that was easy. I'm like, oh, you're from Florence. And he's like, how'd you get the city? I'm like, hey, you're dismissed, right? But here's the point. Authentic subscription is based on knowledge, and inauthentic subscription is based on commodification, is based on consumerism. People who do not care that Larry Johnson didn't wear Jordans, I'm wearing a Larry Johnson jersey with this pair of Air Jordans, right? Or I'm buying this shoe because I'm going to wear it six times and I'm going to sell it for five times more than what I paid for, depending on what year that is. But the point is, inauthentic is concerned with how do I make a dollar out of this, right? Going to the Scholastic Book Fair, it, for those who are of that age, it'll be a book on sneakers, but it'll be inauthentic sneaker culture literature because it's just pictures of sneakers that are hard to get, like the sneakers that people want. Like, oh my gosh, I can't afford the sneaker, but I can afford this book. That makes it inauthentic. So again, authentic sneaker culture subscription is about knowledge. Inauthentic is about a profit making money.
And so the authentic in the knowledge, it's tied to a particular player, let's say, for instance, or a particular team. And therefore, you know the backstory between that footwear, that player, that team. Is that the knowledge that we're talking about here?
That's a small piece. So knowledge could be things of like, okay, for example, I know that this particular sneaker was manufactured here. I know that this sneaker was inspired by this. I know that this sneaker is probably like literally anything you mentioned, like other hobbies or other subscriptions. There would be some individuals who would be highly offended if you were to confuse Star Wars with Star Trek, right? There would be individuals who would be offended if you confuse University of Arizona with Arizona State, right?
Yeah.
So in that particular way, that type of knowledge. And of course, within that, you know, knowing this player, well, that's a part of it. But that speaks more to, oh, that gets back to the consumerism. Like, for example, an authentic subscriber, I'm on a record, but this is definitely on a record. An authentic subscriber, there's a way that they will wear a particular pair of shoes. And I'm going to use this example, this specific real example, okay? If you're wearing a pair of sneakers for utility, let's say you're out mowing the lawn or you're cutting grass or you're running, right? They're probably going to be laced and tied tight, right? Because they're for utility. You don't want your shoe to slip off while you're cutting grass. You definitely don't want it to come off while you're running. So I'm going to use this particular silhouette, which received a lot of mainstream popularity within the last 5 to 6 years. The Nike Dunk. Most people will recognize that silhouette by the black, white colorway that people started referring to as pandas, like the panda colorway because it's black and white. This is how you know someone is an authentic subscriber if they were wearing a pair of Dunks. And we're not talking about Nike Dunk SBs, which SB stands for Sandy Bodecker, and also skateboarding because it's a line of sneakers that support skateboarding. Because the Dunk was popular in the skate community and they started manufacturing Dunks that featured a little bit more technology for skateboarding, right? To recognize that tie-in from back in the day. So if I were to walk into, let's say, Kroger, the grocery store, and I saw someone wearing a brand new pair of Dunks, I would look and see how they were laced. And if they're laced like someone is about to run a marathon, definitely not an authentic subscriber because an authentic subscriber would never do that. Now, is that an insult to the person wearing them? Absolutely not, because you wear your clothes the way that you want to wear them. But an authentic subscriber, just it's not something you do with an authentic subscription. Not saying they have to be unlaced, but authentic subscribers don't tightly lace their footwear. So that's one way of identifying, like, ah, we have all, just one small thing, right? You have things that go deeper and more complex than that. But looking to see if they have their shoes laced tightly. Oh, those shoes are popular and you want to be popular. Or there's a line from the rapper Juvenile from the song Ha, which I consider this to be literary theory. The song is called Ha. And of course, Ha, people from New Orleans, they may put that in their sentence. Like, hey, you just got to work, huh? You smell good today, huh? Right? That at the end. It may not be that dramatic, but that's usually in their colloquial speech. The song Ha celebrates that. But there's literary theory in it, and it has to do with Marxism. There's a line that says, that's you in that big body Benz, huh? Right? And then he says another line. He comes back later to say, that ain't yourn, that's for your friends, huh? Translation, that's not yours. You bought that because the people who you are around appreciate that. Even though you don't like it, you bought it because they like it.
Please take 2 seconds to click the follow or subscribe button on your podcast player. You can set it once and forget tracking down each weekly episode. This makes your life easier and signals to the algorithms that the show should be recommended to other listeners. A simple act that can have an outsized positive impact on others.
And an individual who might be wearing a pair of Nike Dunks tightly laced and tied are definitely, oh, these are the trendy shoes of the day, of yesterday, because, you know, this fashion moves, right? But if I were to look down and see that, I'm like, ah, you're not necessarily an authentic subscriber, but you're wearing these because this is what the trend is, and this is how the people who you saw wearing them are wearing them. Yeah. So you just replicated that. So yeah, in that particular way.
All of that is super helpful to understand, to give insight. All right. With that bit of explanation, how are you using sneaker culture to teach literature, or how do those things now come together?
Gotcha. So think of it this way. The same way that I've taught classes on postmodern Southern Lit, American literature, New England Romanticism, these are all forms of literature that represent place, space, time, and individuals of that area. Sneaker culture literature is no different than New England Romanticism. It's no different than postmodern Southern Lit, because these individuals have lives and stories and issues the same way that in Faulkner, let's see, a character, Huey Dell. Everyone has a life and they have issues, right? Sneaker culture literature is no different than Southern Lit. It's no different than New England Romanticism. It's no different than American Lit. These stories in this work exist. Like I mentioned earlier, you have authentic and inauthentic. And I love sharing that example I gave of the student going to the Scholastic Book Fair and seeing a book that on cover it says it's about sneakers, but it's not a whole lot written there. It's just a bunch of pictures of sneakers that they know they can't get. They can't ask mom for these. Like, these are retailing for, I don't know, $300. I can't ask my mom for that. But what I can do is the same way in the 80s, there were students who were going to the book fair to get a book or get a poster of a Ferrari and put that poster on the wall. There's no way they're getting a Ferrari at 12, right? There's no way they're getting a pair of Louis Vuitton Dons at 12. But what they can do is get this book with this picture on it and put that picture on a wall, and that picture becomes a goal and probably inspires that person to start a company or to change the world in some particular way where, you know, they can have those desires that they wanted as a kid. So again, sneaker culture or literature is no different than any other sub-genre of literature. But within it, you have authentic and you have inauthentic.
Wow. So for your students coming in, the lessons that they will take out will be how to better understand literature, elements of literature. So correct me on that where I'm wrong. And then, but also appreciating sneaker culture as well, or is that?
That may be a byproduct. Because, you know, the same way I could take a class on Emily Dickinson, not saying that I didn't appreciate Emily Dickinson. I'm not saying that.
Yeah. All right.
But there was a time when I was in an intensive study on Dickinson and my life had stood a loaded gun, right? I'm thinking, my life had stood a loaded gun. I'm thinking like, man, you know, some of this is great and some of this I don't relate to as much. And I let me just, because I use that specific example, do I relate to Dickinson? Absolutely. Not as much as someone who's from Massachusetts may. Maybe not as much as a woman who's a little shy. Yeah. But the point is this. There are students who, a good number of students I've taught in the Souls of Black Folk or in the class Soul Food Digestible Sneaker Culture, Many of them are not subscribers to sneaker culture. They aren't authentic or inauthentic. But what they do recognize is like, wait a minute, this is an opportunity to take something other than Dickinson, other than Faulkner, other than Melville, other than Alice Walker. So this represents, this is still lit, but just talking about different things. And the rules of literature apply. Nothing changes. The same way we want to talk about symbols in literature. Like, for example, something random off the top of the dome. If you see a fireplace, if you see a fireplace in literature, is it lit or is it not lit? If it's lit, it's probably representing a warm relationship or functionality. And if it's not lit, there's probably some dysfunction going on. And there are things that you could point. I'm not saying there are fireplaces in story. It may be, depending on what the work is, right? There are a lot of narratives that are centered around sacred culture. As a matter of fact, The Hate U Give is an amazing example of sneaker culture literature. Now, here's the thing. Angie uses The Hate U Give, uses sneaker culture as a Trojan horse, no pun intended, because of course, you know, the Trojans, you know, Virginia State University, but she uses sneaker culture as a Trojan horse to address complicated issues that are not easy to talk about. Chief among them, violence, police violence, inequality in healthcare, disparity between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Like, she uses sneaker culture to address these things. When it comes to things like laws, you know, these laws apply to some and not to others. And that book, even though it uses sneaker culture as a facade, once you're in, you start to recognize, like, oh my goodness, this is horrible. People really live like this. Think of, and this is heavy, but think of Harriet Beecher Stowe, of Uncle Tom's Cabin, okay?
Yeah.
There were individuals, I know it sounds like, King, you're going too heavy with this, but think about it this way. There were individuals who were oblivious to the atrocities of slavery until they read that book. And I sincerely, well, I don't believe, I know, there are individuals who are not aware of elements of police brutality, and they could be reading that book, or maybe they read that book and were like, wait a minute, what? I identify with this character. This happened? So again, that's an example of capital L sneaker culture literature. Now, one may argue, is it authentic or inauthentic just by the terms that are used? And I'll give you an example of that. Ken, if you and I were having a conversation about sneakers, I'm going to mention sneakers directly by name, okay? Because I'm an authentic subscriber. I want to tell you the same way I mentioned the Air Jordan Revolution. If someone were to say to me and refer to the Air Jordan Revolution, I know that person's an authentic subscriber, because Nike doesn't even call the Air Jordan 3 that, okay? Like, where'd you get that? Like, that type of information, you just don't happen upon the internet, even though you may come about it. So here's the point. Yeah. One may say that she wrote from the perspective of being an inauthentic subscriber, or that she wanted her characters to be inauthentic. That's for someone else's conversation. But the point is, no matter how you slice that particular work, it is apex, and it is a prime example of capital S sneaker culture literature.
Wow. As you mentioned when we kicked off, this idea, we may not know what jobs students are going to be having. And so the ability to pull out the insights out of whatever the topic is will give them the tools that they need such that they can interface and be successful in tomorrow's world.
Absolutely.
Just by, because if we only look at some of the capital L's that are out there and only concentrate on those, then there's a missed opportunity, I'll say, to be able to connect something a bit more recent or the things that folks are living with today, to be able to tease out and to be able to look for what those elements are, make sense of them, and then how to integrate those and look for opportunities.
Yes. And with that also, you know, again, in my life, and perhaps in yours as well, there may have been courses where you felt as if this course was made for me. I feel seen here. And having courses, you know, new school pedagogy or new school courses, having courses that are traditional as far as their DNA, but they may be addressing forms of literature that were not considered to be academic before, or interests that were not previously considered to be academic, definitely giving students a voice. When you feel a part of something, you become invested, and when you're invested, you go all in. And I'll share this short story from last semester in the class of Souls of Black Folk. So again, I believe in not putting people on a spot, whether it's for something good or bad. But when I was a student at IUP, I had a professor, Dr. Emmerich. We would walk into class, and this was a Southern Lit class, ironically. We would walk into class, and we would have these monstrous assignments that we had to do every week. And we would turn them in on like a Monday. And he would come back like on a Tuesday, and he would have one and he would just read it, right? And you had no idea whose paper that was unless it was yours. I will never forget this. The first assignment that we did, the assignment was 4 pages, okay? 4-page response to this particular literature. Okay, I wrote it. I responded to the literature in 4 pages. My first grade in a PhD program was a C, and I thought the world had collapsed, and I was about to collapse with it. I'm looking at this like, oh my God. And I had just had knee surgery at the time, so I was on a walker, right? And I waited for everyone else to leave. And I got on the walker and I walked up to him and I was like, you know, what did I do wrong? And he said, you wrote 4 pages, right? And then he mentioned, and to this day, I believe this was a challenge, a good thing. He just said, you have classmates that wrote more than 4 pages. And there were comments and things on the paper. They were traditional. Those comments were enough to give me a C on the paper, right? So I went back to my apartment and I thought like, okay, what he said to you was, you're BSing. The next assignment was, of course, the next response was 4 pages. And I wrote 12. And of course, I got an A. And the one after that, I think I wrote 20. I wrote 20 pages for a 4-page response. And he walked in and he read mine, the one that I wrote 20. And it was for, if I remember correctly, it was for Alice Walker's By the Light of My Father's Smile. And I remember that was the day I arrived. I thought, like, I belong. Okay, I belong here today. Like, you know, there's no doubt. Like, I jacked up that first one. I did well on the second one, but on this third one, I arrived, right? So the point is, I felt seen in that particular instance. And for students, again, they don't have to be interesting. Again, most of the students I've had are not into sneaker culture. Some of them, you know, they may wear sneakers, but they're not authentic, inauthentic or authentic subscribers. But they recognize the opportunity to study lit in a way that they have not studied before, or subject matter. The rules remain the same. It's just that the interstate may be different, but it's still the same car.
Wow. Clearly, we just figured out another reason that I haven't done a PhD program.
Listen, that's not my story. May not be somebody else's story, but there's some similarities. Everything, but I just know that. I was. There's a difference between being taken aback and being upset. I was taken aback, and I'm like, if I get one more of these, I'm done. Like, this is, there is no tomorrow, right? And he clearly explained why. And I got it. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense to me. Someone may argue that's cool, that's not, but it made sense to me because, again, that's not a place for just doing average work, right? Now, I don't know what else, whatever, how many pages they were turning in. He just told me, I told you 4, you turned in 4, and your classmates didn't. So, and by the way, he didn't say this, but let's keep it real. Not only was I the only minority in the program, but you best believe I was the biggest minority. So you put those together, and even when it applies stereotypical thoughts, I stuck out like a sore thumb for a lot. And I couldn't walk at the time either. So, you know, you're this gargantuan African-American dude in a program that does not have a lot of men, period, much less black ones. And if there was one, he wouldn't look like a defensive tackle that's on the IL. Okay. So there you go.
I've been doing some weekly writing. I really enjoy writing. I'm just not real fast. And as I just think about the time put into how much it takes for me to create something good, I'm like, whew, Yeah, 20 pages. That'd be a minute for me to put together. So I'd probably need the week to be able to pull that together.
Well, think of it this way. I'm no different. The muse will visit. And when the muse visits, you know, you welcome her in and you get to work. There may be some days when she won't show up and you need her to. But when she does, she shows up. I will say this. You just mentioned in how you're writing a little portion of your writing process, which is not that different from mine. But I can say this. There's a song by the Redhead Kingpin. I want to say this is from 1989 called We Don't Have a Plan B. Right? If it's not from 89, it's from 90, but that's not the point. The song title and the thesis of that song, or the hook, We Don't Have a Plan B. And when I got that first assignment back, I did not have a plan B. And I'm like, hey, either the muse shows up or I go and get her. But I gotta step this up.
We have an appointment. We are going to do this.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about your upcoming work that you've got going on. How do questions inform your latest work, The Big House on Flavin?
Yeah. So with The Big House, the questions that influence or inform that work are not that different from the things that we've talked about thus far. So here's the thing. There was a good decade where I didn't game at all. I didn't game at all because I didn't have the time, whether it was the program I was in with the PhD or whether it was work. But there was a time where I just wasn't gaming and I didn't even have an up-to-date system. At that time, I had a PlayStation 3 that I barely played when it came out. And when PlayStation 4s came out, I'm like, well, there's no need to buy that because when am I going to play? And I didn't even use the one that I did buy. So, you know, all those games will be new to me if I ever had a chance to play. So after achieving goals and having a little bit more time, it's like, you know what? Let me get back and, you know, play a little bit. And I played a little bit, but every once in a while, I'm a literature guy. If it deals with literature, it's my first love. The game Red Dead Redemption 2 came out in 2018. Now, I had played Red Dead Redemption and even Red Dead Revolver before that, and I love those games for the time period. When Red Dead Redemption 2 released in 2018, not only did I not have a PlayStation 4, but I definitely had no time or no business playing video games at that time. Now, I'm towards the end of a program that people don't finish because they go and do things like they want to do. Share this. When we were in that program, we were taught, because it was in Pittsburgh, or near Indiana, PA, which is close to Pittsburgh, you don't have time to do anything but study. I'm like, yeah, get out of here. Like, the Mets, you can't tell me I don't have time to go see the Mets. And there were days where I had to decide whether I was going to eat or shave, because that's the only amount of time I had to do, right? Eat or
go. Wow.
And I'm like, these people don't know me. I'm going to eat, and I'm going to go to class looking unshaved, right? Looking like a castaway. But here's the point. When Red Dead Redemption 2 came out, I knew it was out. At that time, I was not gaming. Make a long story short, I didn't get a chance to play it until 2023. And when I tell you that game is 1,000% literature, it is everything that I love in a video game. It is history. It is lit. It is the fall of not only the West, but it's the fall of the South as well. Again, for a guy who was, before all the things that we're talking about today, postmodern Southern literature is my area. It is also a question of what is maturity? What is masculinity? How does a society fall? Anything that you study, I promise you, is within the game. And we talked about this offline. The things that I am invested in, I am all the way in. And there were times when, you know, I'm in class, I'm in lecture, and I'm making tie-ins from the game to literature. And students, of course, have played it, they get it. And it's been a few years, but I remember that. So I'm thinking, like, man, this game is leaking into every aspect of my life. Like, people who know me closely, I'm starting referencing characters like, you know what Thomas Downs did, right? You know, Thomas Downs represents this. Or, you know, Arthur Morgan is blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, wow. So one particular day, I remember it well. I was driving, and there was no passenger with me. But I looked over, and the muse showed up. I pulled over, and I promise you, I raised my right hand. This is what happened. I pulled over, and I pulled my phone out. And while the car was running and I was parked, I wrote a couple of notes. And then by the time I got home, the muse hadn't left. It had not left. So I wrote this concept. I wrote a little bit more, a little more. Next thing you know, I was working on a project. And I, at that point, didn't have a home for, didn't even tell anybody I was doing it. I just want to write this. So The Big House on Flavian is inspired by the greatest game I've ever played, which is Red Dead Redemption 2. But it's also informed by hip-hop culture, by hip-hop music, by literally the things that we've talked about today, not necessarily sneaker culture, but the inspiration for the things we talked about. What is literature? What does literature represent? These are questions that come along with that book. Well, guess what? I've already told you that that game is 1,000% literature. There are the question, are there books about this game? Well, of course, there are books like strategy. Well, back when the game came out, they were still making strategy guides, right?
Yeah.
And there's a couple other books. So I know there's another book of a gentleman who wrote about how the West informs the game, right? I like how the Wild West informs the game. So like any other author at any point in life from any region, when you have a song in your heart, you write. So the questions associated with it, I've already addressed, but this is another question. What happens to a dream deferred, right? Literally, what happens to a dream deferred? Now, we know the answers to that or the theory behind that, but I'm like, what happens when you have to get this out? You have a story to tell, or you have a song to sing, or a thought to share. And what happens is that my love for that particular game, now, there are a lot of games I've played in life, a lot of games I've played recently, but I haven't played that game in a little bit in a while. But yet and still, the impact that it had on or has on me, the scholar, the person, the gamer, whoever I am, whatever I am, it left an impact on me, and that is my gift back to it. And again, it's inspired by all of me, but to read it, if one who played it, you would definitely recognize the inspiration, but you would have to play the game to know that.
So if you can help me understand, when you say that the game is literature, can you help me? Can you tie that together? Because I don't know how to connect those dots.
Okay, absolutely. So the game is literature because the story that is told, if that story was written down, it would be Faulkner. It would be Alice Walker. It would be Melville. It's set in the West and in the South. That's part of it. I won't spoil it for listeners or watchers. But the story itself is a well-written piece of literature, okay? The narrative. Also within that narrative are references to history and authentic writers. For example, let's see. Goodness, I just mentioned his name a couple of days ago. But there are representations of authentic individuals, and some of them are authors, because again, somebody might go and play this game because I've said this. So I don't want to give away too much. But there are capital L writers that exist within that game. But of course, they're not named for who they actually are. But if you've read, if you know what Walden Lake is, or know where they, like, you start to recognize, oh, wait a minute, that's such and such. Or this president is that president. Or, you know, this robber baron is that robber baron, or those robber barons in real life. So the point is, the narrative is one of the most intricate and pristine narratives I've ever experienced in gaming. That's the literature portion. And also, there are books that you can actually read within the game as well. Like, you can literally read, you can stop playing a game and read a whole novel within the book, because the novel's there and you can open it and read it. So, yeah, the world in the game is detailed. And for a guy who has a PhD in literary criticism, this is right up my alley. And of course, I didn't expect that. I knew the story had to connect somehow to Red Dead Redemption, which I played in 2010. I played it one time and didn't play it again. So I had to remind myself, like, while I'm playing, I'm like, wait a minute. Didn't this happen? And again, it had been since 2010 and 2023, right? with no videos, with no revisiting, because again, I've been busy since then, but it is literature in that particular way.
That's fascinating that the game manufacturer, you know, the game creators,
Rockstar,
just melded all that together.
They're known for their works being so detailed that it takes years for them to release. For example, a lot of individuals will recognize the Grand Theft Auto series, right?
Yep.
Grand Theft Auto series is the bell cow of Rockstar Games, right? It's their moneymaker. It generates millions and millions of dollars daily, almost. But here's the point. Grand Theft Auto 6 is scheduled for May 2026 release. You can go and look this up if you ever get bored. There are people who do not want to die before that game comes out. This is the story that this gentleman gave up smoking because he wants to make sure that he's here.
Wow.
Listen, go and pull it up. He gave up smoking because he wants to be in good health and be able to enjoy that game when it comes out. To give you an idea of these timelines, Red Dead Redemption 2 released in 2018 and is still one of the top downloaded and purchased games in 2025. Grand Theft Auto 5 released in 2013. And people are still playing it. We're what? It's 2013 and we're 2025. People are still playing it today like it was 2013. It takes that long for them to make the next one. So it's not like this is a cookie cutter situation. We just want to throw this out there and make money. It's so detailed. They're so detailed that it takes that long to create them. And mentioning literature the same way, you know, the way that Faulkner wrote, you're reading a Faulkner novel and one character shows up in another, even if it's briefly, you're like, wait a minute. Like, right? I always love anything that I've read. I love the universes that writers create. When you have, even if there's someone just walks into a general store, when characters show up from one work to, is that great Easter egg or that great, is it a get back or payback to the reader? Oh, the way that these, we got a game set in the 19th century or set in specifically in 18, let's say it was 1891. And then you got a game set in 2013 and they connect. Again, it's literature in that particular way as well. You're like, wait a minute, that president from that game, his descendants are like, but as far as RDR2 is not something you should speed through. And unfortunately I was that guy because I had a weekend, it was a 4-day weekend or whatever it was at that time.
Yeah.
And I went through the entire game in 4 days and that's not, it just shows you how I just wanted to get to the narrative. Let me just get through this. And I recognized when I got to the epilogue, I'm like, oh man, there were some things that I actually missed. This game is a pot roast, not a steak-em. Okay. Mm. You know, you can cook a steak-em pretty quick, but you're not cooking a pot roast quick. A pot roast is probably going to feed a household. And if you're a one person household, you're not eating a pot roast in a couple of days.
Right.
Unless you just don't believe in leftovers, you're not doing it at all. RDR2 is a pot roast of mammoth proportions. And it takes that long to enjoy and to discover. And I went through it like a hot knife on butter. And when I stopped playing, 97 point something percent. But to get to 100, there are gambling challenges. And I've never played. So here's the thing. What is it, like a blackjack? There's certain games I've never played. And I know the premise of blackjack or poker, but there's a certain number of hands you have to win in this. And those are mini games within the game. I'm like, oh man, I can't get 100% until I win 16 hands of blackjack, like something of that nature. I'm like, man, I don't even know how to play it. So you have to go and learn to be good at blackjack to bring it back to the game. Because I will tell you this, the same way if you were to attempt to play poker or blackjack or any other table game, card game in real life, you're going to be playing against people who know what they're doing. Right? The artificial intelligence, it knows what it's doing. So it's not like so you have to be good at it. I'm like, oh man, this is immersive. So to get a 100%, you gotta go have to learn to do that so you can bring it back to the game and win it that way. That's just one small aspect.
Wow. So is this a game that you would go back and play as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are people who, they talk about their playthroughs. I'm on my sixth playthrough, and I didn't notice this the first time. I'm on my eighth playthrough, and I didn't notice
it. Okay.
Now, I've only had one playthrough because I want to get that 100%. But there's a rumor that there's a updated version of that, which is going to release before Christmas. And if that is true, and it may have additional downloaded content, it may have some new themes, right? It may. But if that is the case, then that would be my second playthrough. And because I already know where everything is, there are certain things that will be a little easier. For example, I don't want to ruin the game, but I will say this. You don't have any money when the game starts. And you have to, you know, there's certain things that you need to do. You need money, right? The game, there's a problem that the game has, and you need money. Now I know the quickest ways to get money because I know where the money is and how to get it. Gotcha. That type of thing. Or I just know where everything is now, so certain things will be easier. Not saying it will be completely easy. There's one, and I will say this. There's one particular puzzle. Even though I knew what the answer was, it's so difficult. I don't wish to play that puzzle again at all. Even though I know if you've forgotten prime numbers, you might want to revisit that before if you ever get to that particular puzzle. There's this cave, and there's these statues. There's like six or seven, like a room full of statues, right? And you have to go up and press buttons on certain statues. And if you do it in correct order, the last statue or drawer will open, and there will be a gold bar. I can't remember if it's one or two, but the gold bar is there. If you think about how much a gold bar was worth during that particular time period, that is a significant amount of money. And I remember, and if you go there and it's daytime, you have a little bit more light. So, you know, it'll be illuminated. But if you go at night, you can barely see because all the statues are holding up fingers. That's how you identify what numbers. You really can't see them if it's that dark. Now I was trialing. I'd be like, I know this one, this one, this one. And I would make a mistake and you have to go back and reset them all. But anyway, that particular puzzle, even though I know the answer, I don't need that money. I don't need that money. So I know where some other gold bars are. I do not want to go back there. But yeah.
Wow. Your ability to hold details is just impressive. My brain doesn't work like that to be able to hold. Like my son, he can hold statistics, sports players, and all that kind of thing. I'm like, man. For me, every day is Groundhog Day. You wake up and clean slate and we just roll with it. So that game, one playthrough for me would be 6 years. So it's
for some, it is 6 years, but it's an enjoyable six. But the story, the same if you've ever read a book and you're like, there was Mick Foley wrote a book called Have a Nice Day. And I remember I hadn't read anything like it before. That particular book I read in one sit. I can't remember how many pages it is, but it's not like it's got to be at least 200, 300, whatever it was. I can't remember, but I just know I picked it up at 6 o'clock and I put it down at 2 a.m. And the only time I got up was to use I didn't eat dinner that night. I got up to use the restroom twice in that sitting and I read the whole, but I just like, you expect me to go to bed after reading this? I'm supposed to wake up tomorrow and pick this up? Like, nah, I got to go to work. So I need to read it. This is back in 2000. I was in grad school. I'm like, I got to read this tonight because I got stuff to do tomorrow and I don't want to wait till I do all the stuff to get back to reading it. Game is similar to that, but there are people who slow walk it and take their time.
Yeah.
And then you got idiots like me that's like, I got something to do on Monday, so let's wrap this up by Sunday night, right? So, but yeah, thank you for the compliment. The compliment is not lost on me. We're all unique and we all come together to form Voltron in some particular way. But, I appreciate the compliment because I identify with that.
Absolutely. Let's see. Any particular questions that you, let me ask you about the right now question. Then we can follow up with this other one. So right now questions, and this is something other than what's for lunch or dinner. And if I'm going to get married, the big ones there. And this is any particular question that you're living with right now, that you're carrying with you. What would be your right now question?
What is the cost of staying small? And let me explain.
Mm.
So whether it be with the Institute, whether it be with soul food brand, whether it be with just me personally, like not saying like big, like I'm like X amount of weight loss or this and that. What is the cost of being small? Meaning, for there are many of us who silence ourselves or we don't shoot the shot, right? Like literally, I'm open. Give me the ball. Let me shoot. There's a popular cultural expression that what scared money doesn't make money, right? But again, is it going to be more costly to not give one's all, to not take some risk, or is it going to be more costly to do it? And to be quite honest with you, Ken, is my personal belief that the cost of staying small are far more costly, and I use that word again, than of attempting to grow. Green tomatoes, the beauty in a green tomato is that it grows. It matures, right? Red tomatoes, they're ripe, but there's decay shortly thereafter. So what is the cost of not maturing, right? You know, there's a fear of like, when you know, I can mature to the point where I advance to the point where I can't advance anymore. Well, you won't know if you don't do that. So what are the costs of staying small? And that could be, when we can apply that to personal, to business, to relationships. It may be cool where you're at, but how much longer? And what comes from that, right? And again, not telling someone to quit their job or to run from Arizona to New York. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that if we don't take, and I'm not talking about chances like I'm going to throw this football into double coverage. I'm not talking about that. But at the same time, cars were meant to be driven. Books were meant to be written. Thoughts were meant to be shared or plans executed. So what's the cost of staying small?
That's a helpful reminder and challenge.
One that I ask myself, not daily, but let's just say every other day. Like I ask myself consistently. Let's just say that.
Has that question been a catalyst for you?
Yes. In some ways, before I asked that of myself, the thought process was there, right? I remember this is early in my professional career. I was teaching seventh grade English. And there was an assembly one day, and I forgot the presenter's name, but I did not forget their message. And they shared this analogy, this story, where there was this bird. This bird was in a cage, and the owner would come and feed it. And all it could do was fly around this pole in this cage. And one particular day, the owner was late for work, and it fed it and left the cage door open. That bird continued to fly around the pole, not recognizing that the opportunity to I won't use the term escape, but if you're being caged, you're escaping, right?
Right.
The opportunity, it was lost upon that bird because all it knew was flying around the pole. It didn't even see, it didn't recognize that it was an opportunity. That sticks with me. I think of that all the time. That story is for the students. And I was a first year teacher. And I'm like, man, he's talking directly to me, right? And the next year, I got my first college teaching position, like literally the next school year. Was it the next year? Hold on, let me get it straight. Yes, it was the next year I got my first college job. And I worked both. And a couple of years after that, I got my first full-time college job. And of course, that transition led to the conversation we're having today.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not knocking someone for any job that they do because all jobs are important. But at the same time, what happens to a dream deferred, right? Mm. So, yeah. It may be easier. It may be safer. It may be more comfortable to remain caged. However, you are not growing if you don't take that opportunity to go beyond. The door's open. Fly out. And the door's, if you know, you can fly back if you want to be oppressed, right? But again, when people get a taste of freedom, whether it be financial, whether it be escaping an abusive relationship, whether it be oppressed by maybe a job, right? When people get a taste of freedom, I would like to think the majority of the time they don't return. You know, there are some people who do return because of, you know, being just oppression, things that come along with oppression, whether it's Stockholm Syndrome and things of that nature. But when people taste freedom, they want to continue to taste that. So there we are.
I've been thinking a lot about insights and who we are as humans. For most of my life, insights have not been something that have necessarily been asked of me or that I've offered and that I've pursued. I was an E5 in the military.
Thank you for your service.
Oh, absolutely. And my response is always, you are worth it. I heard that and I was like, that is exactly the right response. And I was a great E5. So E5 in the pay scale on the enlisted side goes from E1 to E9. So right in the middle. I was a submarine radioman. The role is do the communications, and if stuff breaks, go fix it. Nobody questioned me about, hey, do we have all the right parts? Is the budget set right for having those parts available? Is the training appropriate for this? And a bunch of those kinds of bigger questions. And it's like, that is good cog work. I would submit that us humans are here for more than just to be the cog. Instead, to me, the output is our insights because of our backgrounds, because of our interests. And so I enjoyed talking with you is because you got such a unique, what I would consider a unique collection of insights. The Venn diagram has a different mix than other people that I've met. So it's been fantastic.
Thank you.
And it's like those insights, that to me is where humanity is. That's the thing of value that we bring. And I'm excited for your students that take your class because now by virtue of them going through your class, they will probably experience different insights as a result later on down the line, whether that's a year or 20 years. But it's that insight. And so how can we foster those insights? How can we set that expectation for ourselves to invite them use? And let's have this conversation and help me iterate on this and help me reflect on it. But it's like, that's what we bring. That's where the freedom is, as we can share those insights. The caged bird is not intent on sharing or having insights. So yeah, take advantage of the open door and get after it.
Get after it. We find that the cost of staying small is more expensive to stay small than to take a calculated risk or to, I don't want to take it to a biblical extent, but to bury a talent, right? Because that's exactly, the cost of staying small is probably burying some talent. And buried talents don't usually return. They're taken from us. What is the cost of that? And that's a cost that I'm not willing to pay. Not at this particular point in life, not before, and hopefully not later. But yeah, I'm, at this juncture, I'm not willing to calculate or take the losses, to take that, whatever, however that price is, I'm not willing to pay it.
The world's a better place because you're unwilling to pay that cost.
I thank you. It is also a better place because of not only your service, as you mentioned a moment ago, but a platform of this magnitude and giving individuals like myself an opportunity to be seen and heard. Because as you know, I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know, but a story's untold until someone feels like there's an audience for it. And even if that audience is one individual, it's worth it. So your platform allows that one, and of course we know there's more than that, but there's one individual that has heard something that resonates with them. And one becomes some and some become many. So thank you.
As you thought about this conversation and thinking about questions, is there anything that you were looking forward to talking about that we haven't covered down on to be able to connect questions with your world and what that looks like?
No, I think you've asked poignant and I definitely had an opportunity to open up on questions. I don't think there's anything, there's a stone particularly unturned. I will say we've talked about their jobs that are being, have not yet been created, that my students will end up being leaders within these jobs down the line. But the Institute, whether it be classes like the Souls of Black Folk, the Institute of Hip Hop and Cultural Studies, the Hip Hop Studies minor, or just Virginia State University in general, greater happens here at Virginia State University. And that greater is the product that we are releasing into the world, which is our students, and making new school pedagogy. We're creating a new school leader. So I know we talked about that generally, but specifically, I know that's what we're doing.
That's a beautiful investment. Yeah.
Indeed.
And worthy. Where is the best place for folks to track you down, learn about what you're excited about, and support you?
Oh, thank you. So my license in NCAA apparel and even literature is available via soulfoodbrand.com, SoulFoodBrand.com. Also, JermaineLevarKing.com. It'll take you to the same place. Virginia State University, regarding the Institute, regarding the English minor, the English major, or just the university in general, VSU.edu, you know, greater happens here. And any books that I've written, you can find them where all fine books are sold. The Big House on Flavian is scheduled for a late October 2025 release. So I look forward to all things for Kindred Spirits, for those who have played the game or just Kindred Spirits. They didn't even have to play the game to enjoy the book, but those who will, that book is written for us, for all Kindred. So I look forward to that as well.
Fantastic. Well, Jermaine, thank you for your intentionality in everything you apply yourself to, and for using your creativity in such a way that it uplifts and celebrates the culture. And I appreciate you delivering so many insights to the Curated Questions community. I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you.
Kid, thank you for having me. Curated Questions is an amazing platform, and I am honored to be a part. So thank you for having me.
Ken here. Dr. Jermaine King took us on a fantastical journey from classical literature to sneaker culture literature and through hip-hop history. How Rockstar Games has infused their imaginary worlds with so much detail that players are motivated enough to make difficult lifestyle changes to ensure they are alive to play the next release, and literary PhDs will write books to honor the capital L works experienced in the pursuit to finish the game. This conversation has been a fulfilling pot roast meal. These are four takeaways I realized. What resonated with you? Number one, from cultural prejudice to recognizing parallel narratives. Jermaine's insight that Southern hip-hop and Southern literature are one and the same, because both were initially dismissed as inferior, reveals how geographic and cultural bias shape our perception of artistic value. Just as people thought, people from the South are stupid, so that stuff that they write is going to be stupid, the same prejudice initially dismissed Southern hip-hop artists, when Outkast and other Southern artists proved their lyrical sophistication, it forced a reconsideration of assumptions about regional creativity. This pattern, initially dismissed, followed by eventual recognition, appears repeatedly when marginalized voices break through established cultural hierarchies. I know I'm guilty of this dismissal. This conversation will inspire a pause to check for unfounded critical judgments based on cultural bias as I go forward. Question: what voices or artistic expressions are you unconsciously dismissing based on their origin, and how might your biases be preventing you from recognizing their actual quality? Number two, from consumerism to authentic cultural participation. Jermaine's distinction between authentic and inauthentic sneaker culture subscription reveals a more profound truth about how we engage with any community or interest. Authentic participation is based on knowledge and genuine expression, while inauthentic participation is based on commodification and profit-seeking. His example of recognizing someone's geographic origin by their footwear choices shows how authentic cultural fluency creates invisible bonds of understanding. The distinction between someone buying Jordans to flip for profit and someone who knows Larry Johnson didn't wear Jordans represents the difference between exploiting a culture and genuinely participating in it. Engaging Jermaine in his areas of expertise amplified languages in new ways for me. For example, how his communities use authentic, inauthentic, and subscription provided depth I had never considered. Question: in what areas of your life are you participating authentically versus simply consuming or commodifying? And what would deeper knowledge-based engagement look like? Number 3. From curriculum rigidity to pedagogical innovation. When Jermaine's department chair asked, "Does anyone have any ideas for new courses?" because the English major was under attack, it revealed a crucial insight about educational adaptation. The question wasn't wrong, it was essential. Jermaine understood that students entering college would work in careers that don't currently exist, making traditional curricula potentially obsolete. His creation of sneaker culture literature courses demonstrates that academic rigor can be maintained while making content immediately relevant to students' lived experiences. The key is recognizing that we need to reach students where they are without lowering standards. I think about how the rise of AI means no one has a clear understanding of what the future looks like never before. These students must be able to use tools in new ways. Schools must lead with both the historical foundations and demonstrating how to break the molds at the same time. It's crazy. I mean, can you concretely see what mainstream jobs are going to look like in 30 years or in 2055, when these students will be in their peak earning years? It's amazing. Question: what established systems in your field or organization need to evolve to remain relevant, which is even more relevant as AI takes hold? And how can you maintain quality while embracing necessary change? Number 4. From staying small to calculated growth. Jermaine's right now question, "What is the cost of staying small?" captures a universal human tension between safety and growth. His metaphor of the caged bird that continues flying around the pole even when the door opens illustrates how we often don't recognize opportunities for expansion. He argues that the cost of staying small is far more costly than attempting to grow. Comparing it to the green tomatoes that have the beauty of potential growth versus ripe tomatoes that are on the verge of decay. This reframes risk-taking, not as reckless behavior, but as necessary development, where buried talents don't earn a return, but rather are taken. Even as I have been coming through the seismic transition from government employee to entrepreneur, this question pushes at the other areas of life, relationships, health, and community. There is always a frontier awaiting exploration. Question: what opportunities for growth are you not seeing because you've become comfortable flying around the confines of your current situation? And what is the cost to you of never testing your full potential? And that's it. To those on the other side of the speaker, thank you for being here. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. Please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, share, or comment about something that resonated. This action ensures we are engaging the questioning community. Until next time, keep questioning.